Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
Good. How was your week?
Pretty decent.
Anything exciting happening?
You know, I'm riding, trying to take advantage of the season.
It's a long one this year.
Yeah.
It's a hot one.
Little rain, much heat.
Yes. We had some interesting feedback on your Tour de France doping commentary
last
week.
Oh, really?
Yes, you
didn't
did.
Tell me about this.
Did you not read the Facebook page?
No, sorry, I didn't have a chance.
Yeah. Well, people liked what you had to say.
Really?
Well, yes, they did, actually.
Okay, all right.
So I may ask you to expound on the Facebook page in the future. How's that?
Okay, all right. I'll have to check in there and see what they wrote.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We have one very avid listener, Gary, and he immediately said, wow, I really like what Greg had to say.
Huh.
Yeah. Anyway, it's really a strange week, the week that Brian is away on Zoba. You know, he's gone all weekend. I'm hubbub. But at any rate, they've had a really good ride this year. I have to give a shout out to the ride director, Maureen Williams. Evidently, she is just the best route finder, maker, doer of them all.
That's a real art.
It is an art. And everybody says she does a great job. Not too many mishaps. Lots of rain this year. They've had several nasty, nasty storms. But it's over today. And he'll be home. Yay!
Good.
Yay.
He's got to drive all the way back from Marietta?
Marietta.
Wow.
It ain't that far. He says 3.5 hours.
Okay, that's about right, I guess.
Okay.
3.5, 4 hours.
Yeah, well, he'll be burned out for a few days, as he always is. They've been to some interesting places this time. I'm sure he'll have stories. Oh, and if you look on Facebook, you know.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah,
it's
there have been
interesting,
some pictures,
I think.
Yeah. So the Olympics opened this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I'm looking forward to the cycling events. I enjoy almost all of the Olympic events, try to watch some every day. I guess we'll have pretty much coverage, although we're not sure of everything yet. We know for sure that we'll be seeing, what, time trialing, you said?
Women's time trial, I think, is on the NBC Sports Channel Wednesday.
Okay.
And I'm doing some research here. I might check back later in the hour with some more specific dates and times when cycling might be on your television.
Okay. Because I do know when the actual different events are. I have that. On my iPad here, I have them all kind of like laid out. There is a really good Olympic page that shows, I think it's from Cycling, USA Cycling, that shows each of the events and when they are and how long they are and all of that. So I want to thank our fabulous listeners. Remember last week, I wanted to go to 800 likes on Facebook?
Yes.
We're at 810. Or at least we were at 810 this week. So that was like really cool. I'm not much of a goal setter, but I like that. Trying to get used to this tweet thing, though. It always sounds funny. Send me a tweet. Twitter didn't allow for enough characters for the Outspoken Cyclist. So if you want to follow the Outspoken Cyclist on Twitter, leave out the E. It's Outspoken without an E, Cyclist. So we have a show, too. We do have a show tonight. We have really good guests from Richmond, Virginia, which just seems to be a hotbed for cycling activity this year. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, we have a gentleman by the name of Craig Dodson. And Craig took his fairly elite education, which includes a Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science and a Master's in Movement Science, and paired it with this sort of uncontrollable urge to help change the lives of youngsters living in public housing in the inner city of Richmond. In 2008, Craig started the Richmond Cycling Corps, and this year saw some really big successes. Their message, can't stop, won't stop, is changing lives. So we're going to catch up with Craig in a little bit. We'll also talk with Richard Goodwin, who is the public relations liaison for Hutchinson North America. So did you know that Hutchinson has been around since 1853?
I did not.
I know. Isn't that a long time ago?
Yeah.
That's even older than me. they've been making tires since 1890. So we'll learn about the history of the company and how they continue to do some really innovative research and development for the cycling world. You know, they're the tubeless people. So I hope we'll have a few minutes for news, and then I'm going to sign off and go watch some more Olympic coverage. Take a seat, pop the cap off that beverage, and let's welcome Richard Goodwin from Hutchinson to the show. Good evening, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, when we met at press camp in June, I was surprised to learn the long history of Hutchinson. Can you tell us a little bit about how you're connected to the company and a bit of your background?
Sure. I've been in cycling for a long time. I mean, since and a cyclist, I should say, since the late 60s. I think my stepfather was into bicycles and had Schnellies and that level of bicycle in those days. And that was really something in those days because you just couldn't walk into a store and buy a bicycle of that quality. And so he got me into cycling. And in those days, the French were very strong in the market. I mean, the French owned the 50s and 60s and part of the 70s, the French owned the road bike market, really. And then the Japanese came along. But from those days, I always had an affinity for French products. And so going into the 80s, and I raced a little bit as an amateur, too. And then going into the 80s, a friend of mine who was in my club raced as a professional in Europe. And, in fact, he was the first American to ride the Tour de France. His name was Doc Boyer.
Yeah, we talked to him not too long ago.
Yeah, and now he's working for the Rwandan national team.
Right.
Helping coach those guys, yeah. So he was riding for a team that was equipped with all Mavic components, the skill team in France, and he was riding the Tour de France, and he invited me through his friend who owned Mavic to come and work at the Tour de France. So in 1984, myself and another American came to France, and we're dropped in the middle of rural France, and we built bikes for the Colombian team for the Tour de France, and we worked as neutral support mechanics in the Tour de France, and we were the first Americans to do that. And that's a story unto itself.
It really
gave me my second breath of the whole French thing. And Mavic was beginning to be a strong brand in at that period, and that was part of the reason that we were invited to come and work, because what they wanted to do was they wanted to try to build a business in the United States, and they wanted to sort of indoctrinate some Americans into what they were doing and sort of have these guys come back as evangelists for Mavic and sort of help them grow the brand. Well, I ended up returning, and they offered me a job, and I worked for them for 8 years, and started the neutral Mavic neutral support in the U.S. and would go back to France, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, and I did that for 8 years, and I had some great experiences with them, but to the point that just really established the sort of Frank file in me, and to this day I'm still that way, and so my relationship with Hutchinson began as I didn't leave the cycling industry, but I branched off and got into marketing and worked for an advertising agency. And a guy who I had hired at Mavic was then working for Hutchinson, and he needed some help with some marketing endeavors. So he asked me to come along and help him out with doing some very minor things, you know, ad revisions, some translations, things like that, and some really small projects. But slowly over time, and now it's been 10 years, I just realized that I've been working with Hutchinson. Slowly but surely, I've sort of clawed my way up through the ranks, and now I would say I actually have an ongoing, really strong working relationship with the factory and the people at Hutchinson. And it's a great company, it's an interesting company, and it's attractive to me because you know, it's the French thing, and Hutchinson being French, and them also being one of only 4 French companies that sort of survived when the Japanese took over the industry, I would say, you know, there was a lot of French companies that were producing parts for road bikes, and it was Simplex and Huray and Stronglite and TA. And the Japanese showed up, and all these brands just went by the wayside. And there were only really 4 survivors from, I would call, first-generation cycling, French cycling companies. And one of those is Hutchinson. Another one would be Zafau. The third would be Mavic. And fourth would be Michelin. Now, Michelin is only different than Hutchinson in that Michelin has no production in Europe, whereas Hutchinson still does. But really, those are the four companies that are still around since the late 1800s, early 1900s, and still produce products competitive in the market today.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about brands like Stronglight and TA and all those wonderful brands that have gone by the wayside. I mean, they ran the gamut. If you wanted a triple crank or if you wanted a tandem set, those companies made them. And I know that they still might, but they certainly aren't exporting to the United States.
I think what happened with the brands was they died, and then people saw an opportunity to bring them back, and so they did bring them back. And but it's not the same family. It's not the same ownership. I think they just bought the trademark. And perhaps some of the designs of their components they brought back because they felt there was a niche market for that. The French sometimes have a difficult time marketing outside of France, and really reaching out to a global market. And I encountered that a little bit with Hutchinson, but those brands had a lot of cachet back in those days. I mean, there was really only Campagnolo, and then these sort of spattering of French brands that collectively you could put together a group, right?
Right. So Hutchinson started as a factory in 1853, Hiram Hutchinson. What did he build? Because he didn't really start producing tires till 1890, as far as I can tell from the research I did.
Right, that's correct. He started, the safety bike, which really popularized the bicycle as we sort of know it today, sort of the double triangle, same size wheel, front and rear, didn't really appear till the late 1800s. So he'd already established his company as a boot maker. the only shoes available mid 1800s were either clogs or leather shoes, and those didn't hold up well for farmers. So he started making wellies, which are that's kind of like the generic name for Wellington boots, which
right.
are rubber just under the knee boots. You see them around now under a ton of brand names. But he started producing those under the Eagle brand name in France in 1853 and built this factory. And Eiffel, who was famous for the Eiffel Tower, actually designed the factory. And it was built in 1853, and he started producing these boots. And he converted a whole generation of French farmers away from leather shoes and wooden clogs into these boots. And you still, worldwide, I think, especially in Europe, you still find farmers use those boots, So now you see people wearing those even in not on farms, and it's a fashionable item. But that was the first product that Hutchinson made.
Well, it's interesting. I asked for a pair of wellies for the holidays last year and got a pair of bright yellow ones. So I know exactly what you're talking about. They are fashionable.
Yeah.
So today, I want to fast forward a little bit because Hutchinson's enduring. I mean, I sold Hutchinson tires back in the 80s and in the 90s. And, they sort of, to me, now I don't know if this is true, they sort of faded in and out, but suddenly they are Mr. Tubeless.
Yeah. It's interesting because the bicycle, if you think about it, is the only vehicle that's produced in any quantity that still uses an inner tube, whether it's a tubular tire or a clincher tire. Hutchinson co-developed UST tubeless with Mavic and Michelin quite some years ago, and they kind of revolutionized the mountain bike market with tubeless because mountain bikes, people are having a lot of pinch flats, and it just made a lot of sense. In fact, a friend of mine, Jean-Pierre Lacombe, who I just was staying with a couple of weeks ago, he actually is the engineer from Mavic that invented it, effectively. He didn't have the tire company, so he brought Hutchinson and Michelin on board to sort of co-develop it with him, and he was when he was at Mavi. But so that revolutionized the MTB market. Moving forward, you still had the same types of problems existing with road tires. You still had pinch flats. You still had that potentially unsafe situation with a clincher tire, where if you had a severe blowout, the tire could the tire could come off the rim. And so, and you also didn't have, you know, at the highest levels, the team still rode tubulars because clinchers weren't safe enough, and also they weren't quite light enough. Well, there, a lot of progress has been made in clincher technology in terms of weight and performance, and bringing it very close to tubular performance. The most important thing, though, is that if you get a flat tire, you want the tire to stay on the rim. And Hutchinson, with Shimano developing the rim, developed on their own the first road tubeless tire. I mean, I don't know that it was the absolute first that ever existed, but the first working sort of mass production road tubeless tires.
So Shimano, it was the Dura-Ace wheel. It wasn't a Mavic wheel or a Stans wheel.
No, it wasn't.
Aha, interesting.
The first wheel that was available for road tubeless was a Dura-Ace wheel. That made adaption a little bit slow because people had to pay a lot to buy into it, and if you had a campy bike, and at that time the SRAM wasn't really around, you had to use a Shimano wheel, and a lot of people didn't want to do that or plunk down $1,200 to get into the game.
Right.
So today there's numerous wheel sets available on the market which allow you to convert to road tubeless setup for at a lot of different price points. But I think one thing I should make clear also is that there's a little bit of confusion in the road tubeless market because there's conversions and there's real road tubeless.
Right, and I think that's important to make that distinction.
Right, and when I say real road tubeless, what I mean is that means you have a wheel set that's been approved by Hutchinson that's been engineered to match the tire that Hutchinson produces for road tubeless. The other end of that spectrum is tubeless conversions. That means you're taking a kit that's been created to provide to take a normal rim and make it airtight so that the tubeless tire can work in conjunction with a rim that wasn't specifically made for tubeless. It'll work. You add some weight by doing the conversion. Additionally, you don't get one of the best features of a pure tubeless setup. And what I mean by that is it's a pure tubeless setup means that when you mount the tire on a rim, the bead is specifically designed for that rim, and the bead actually locks into the rim when you inflate it. And so that locking ensures that if you flat, that the tire stays on the rim. And with the conversion kit, you don't have that guarantee.
Yeah, we just did a conversion recently on a mountain bike, set of mountain bike wheels, and it was a pain in the neck, frankly, to get one of those wheels to seal properly. And then it was a bear getting those tires on the rim. It was very tough. Very tough.
Right. Because I believe that the tape actually sort of increases the circumference of the wheel, and so you don't have it effectively changes how deep the bead can go into the channel. So when you get to the other side, it can be tight.
Right.
Right. And so, yes, there's disadvantages to the conversion, and we really want to see people using tubeless-specific wheels with our tires.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Richard Goodwin. He is with Hutchinson Tires. He's talking about the tubeless system and about Hutchinson as a company, one of the only four French companies who are still manufacturing for the bicycle industry today in France. So that's kind of an important thing. It's sort of like Americans making American products. Now, when we were at press camp, you were telling me that Hutchinson's coming out with some new tires this fall that would interest some of the touring style riders or people who want a little bit of a wider tire.
Yes, we'll have, later this year, we'll have a 28-millimeter tubeless-ready tire. We call the Intensive 28 as of right now. It's significantly wider than anything we offer right now. The largest diameter in road tubeless we offer is 25-millimeter. And it's a great sort of cross-country, all-terrain, if you want to ride your commuting tire, could work great as a commuting tire. It's actually generated the most excitement of the two tires we're going to launch, the two new road tubeless tires we're going to launch this year. One interesting point about this tire is that in order to keep the weight down, it is what we call tubeless ready. And what that means is that, like our normal tubeless, it doesn't have the butyl liner inside the tire casing, which acts as the seal, because a casing unto itself is not airtight. So it requires that you use a fluid sealant. We make a great sealant, Protector Max, that you can use with that. And that actually seals, makes the casing itself airtight. So with tubeless ready, you're obliged to use a sealant.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, I was excited by that tire because that is one of the drawbacks, that people want wider tires now. You know, some of the rims are going to be wider now. You're seeing more 23-millimeter rims instead of 19s and 21s, so that's kind of cool. So I want to just take a little bit of a diversion before we wrap it up and talk about sponsorship. Hutchinson sponsors Tour de France teams, for example. Has Hutchinson always been involved in sponsoring racing?
Yeah, it's the racing heritage with Hutchinson goes way back. I mean, Hutchinson won its first Tour de France in 1924. Bottecchia, an Italian rider, was hired by a French team. Rode Tour de France. He actually held the yellow jersey from day one throughout the whole race.
Wow.
And that was Hutchinson's first victory in the Tour de France. Since then, I mean, people that know something about it, the history of cycling would, in the mid-century, would certainly know names like Poulidor and Anquetil and Bobet. Between those guys, there must be 8 or 10 Tour de Frances. More recently, Lance Armstrong rode all of his tours on Hutchinson tires and won all of his tours on Hutchinson tires, well, and even including one he didn't win.
Well, that's really cool. So how do you choose a team? How do you decide to offer a team sponsorship, or do they come to you? You know, I've never really asked this question of anybody.
Well, I think it's a two-way street. Teams and director sportifs build relationships with companies. And whether it's tire companies, whether it's component companies, whether it's frame companies, currently, today, we sponsored two teams that were in Tour de France. Francis Dujeux, Big Matt, they won two stages at the Tour. And we also sponsored Europe Car, which is Thomas Vogler's team. He won the mountain climber's jersey
right. On
two stages, and then his teammate won another mountain stage. So between our two teams, we had 5 stage wins. And, yes, the sponsorship happens. That's sort of this insider thing that happens, I was at Hutchinson last year, and we were actually approached by Sky to provide tires for Sky. Different teams have different needs financially and such, and the price to sponsor some teams are higher than others. Sometimes it's money and tires, sometimes it's just tires. There's a whole variety of things, and there's also a whole spectrum of teams that are sponsored. You know, some are continental teams, some are Pro Tour teams. And they'll have a certain amount of cachet with based on the number of riders and what they expect that they can win in a season. And tires, although don't end up kind of being the sexy component, in more ways are one of the most important components, as we saw by that stage that was interrupted by the tax on the course.
Right.
So right. I think people, cyclists know that tires are important, but obviously, oftentimes it's the frames and the grupos get the love in terms of what's sexy on a bicycle and the wheels.
That's true. But you know, I know the tire choice, depending on the terrain and the weather and all those things, that's a really important thing. And I think actually, Velo News, I think, did a big thing about tires for Paris-Roubaix this year for the Giro. I can't remember. And talking about that. Well, you know, this is always interesting to learn about new companies and especially European companies. We don't get to talk about them much. There's a lot of information on the Hutchinson site. Can you give the listeners the URL for the company website?
Sure. It's www.hutchinsontires.com.
You've got lots of cool things up there, and I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me. I enjoyed talking to you at Press Camp, and I enjoyed talking to you again this evening.
Thank you for your time, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome, Richard. Have a good night.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Richard Goodwin joined us from
San
Francisco.
I think.
Does that guy know a lot about tires or what?
I'll tell you what. You know Park City. We were in the Silver Baron Lodge. Hi, everybody at the Silver Baron Lodge. They listen to our show. And I walked into that room, and I'm looking around at these tires and these wheels, and I'm thinking to myself, man, Hutchinson's been around a long time. Mm-hmm. Little did I know that they've been around since 1890. I'm like, wow. But he knows so much about these tires and so much about the history of the company.
Yeah.
And evidently so much about what went on in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It is cool.
All right. So we're glad to have him on the show. Hope you enjoyed that. And I hope you will enjoy a very short break, after which we will come back and bring you some news.
Yes.
And then another guest to round out this evening's Outspoken Cyclist. So stay tuned right after this.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The Artists' Archives of the Western Reserve is pleased to present Craft Exhibition, a gallery display of metal, jewelry, pottery, ceramics, fabric, glass, wood, and functional paper art by 17 local artists. This free show opens with a reception on August 3rd and runs through August 30th at the AAWR Gallery, located at 1834 East 123rd Street in University Circle. Artists' Archives of the Western Reserve is a unique archival facility created to preserve representative bodies of work created by Ohio visual artists. Gallery hours and more information at artistsarchives.org.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to take a few minutes here and see what's happening in the cycling news this week.
There actually was a lot if you looked for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it just comes flying into my email box like the first story here, or sometimes I have to sort of sleuth it out. But I had several people ask me to read a New York Times article called "Cameras Are Cyclists' Black Boxes in Accidents."
Oh, yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it was written by a gentleman by the name of Nick Wingfield, and the article begins with the story we covered about the cyclist who was hit with the pickup truck in D.C. last August. Remember the one that kind of chased him down and then ran him over? It turns out he had a helmet cam on.
Hmm.
Yeah, the article details how the cameras are beginning to actually help ward off assaults and record harassment. One of the most prominent bicycle crash videos so far, wrote Wingfield, was recorded in April by two Brazilian riders who were climbing the hills of Berkeley when a black car knocked them down and sped off. Neither cyclist was seriously injured, according to the Berkeley police. But the video of the crash has been viewed more than 362,000 times on YouTube.
Wow.
Yeah. The Berkeley police identified the car's license plate, later found the man the vehicle was registered to. They believe he falsely reported his car stolen to cover up for the driver of the car and are still investigating the incident. On a recent Friday evening, as the streets of downtown Washington were jammed with cars heading home, Mr. Wildler pedaled away wearing a camera on his forehead, looking like a spelunker wearing a headlamp, scooted between parked cars and traffic on the road, sometimes with less than a foot of space between him and the moving vehicles. And the video Mr. Wildler shot of his crash in D.C., which occurred last August, at first did not seem as if it would help much in tracking down the motorist who had struck him. But Mr. Wilder, who works in the photography department of National Geographic, examined the video frame by frame until he discovered a clear picture of the vehicle's plate captured while he was lying on the ground.
Wow.
Yep. District of Columbia's Office of the Attorney General charged the motorist, John W. Deal, with leaving the scene of an accident. Federal prosecutors who handle felony cases in the district are also looking into the case. So it's interesting how these cameras are starting to be
between your camera and your GPS data. That's right. You've got a little black box rolling around with you potentially.
That's exactly right. Yep.
So this was kind of an interesting article. Josephine McDermott at BBC News in London published an article called "Man Cycles Across the World from China for the Olympics 2012 Opening." When London's mayor accepted the Olympic flag in 2008, a Chinese farmer who was looking on inside the stadium says he was inspired to travel to the next host city for the games by the only way he could afford, a rickshaw. In 2 years, Chen Guanming traveled about 60,000 kilometers through 16 countries, overcoming floods, war zones, mountain passes, and temperatures of minus 30 degrees centigrade. Man, that's cold. His aim, he said, was to, quote, spread the Olympic spirit, unquote. He arrived in London on July 6th.
Huh.
Yep. So this guy, John Beeston from Norwood Green in West London, discovered him at the top of the Lower Regent Street looking completely lost and disheartened. At first, he assumed he was a tourist rickshaw. Then he looked back and said, no, this is something different. Mr. Chen has pictures on his three-wheeled rickshaw of him posing in front of international landmarks and a banner saying he is on a journey of 140,000 kilometers, which includes China. And it goes on to explain what he's doing and that his next goal is hopefully to go to Brazil in 2016 for the next opening. Guess he's staying on the road for a while, huh? Yeah. So you actually have a news item you wanted to insert here, yes?
I do.
Okay.
You know, the country has been largely focused on the shootings in Aurora, Colorado.
Yes.
And there seems to have been kind of a movement to shift the focus of the coverage this time around from the alleged shooter to the victims.
Yes.
And try to focus on their stories. And I think that's kind of a neat thing. I happened on this on the NPR site earlier in the week, and it includes some material that they sourced from the Washington Post.
Okay.
So anyway,
everybody's covered here.
Basically, Stephen Barton, 22 years old, just happened to be in Aurora on the day of the shootings. He arrived in the afternoon. The Denver suburb was a stop on a cross-country bicycle ride that he's on with a friend. When the gunfire began, he was hit in the neck and the face with buckshot, and he thought to himself, there's no way it's going to end here. There's no way I biked 3,000 miles to come to this theater and get killed in it.
Good for him!
He survived the tragedy with his riding partner, Ethan Rodriguez Torrent, who was unhurt.
Very cool.
The friend that they went to the movie with, Petra Anderson of Aurora, has an amazing tale to tell as well. This is from the Washington Post. She had emergency surgery, and doctors discovered that the shotgun pellet in her head had traveled through her brain.
And there's that channel in her brain.
Yes.
She's got that strange brain.
And like a BB through a straw, it apparently carried the pellet through her head without inflicting any serious brain damage.
Right.
Doctors and friends have said that she is walking and talking and is expected to make a strong recovery, according to news reports and a website set up to aid the family. So there was a little cycling connection and a relatively happy ending to boot.
Yeah, no kidding. How lucky was he?
Yeah, all three of them. Very, very lucky. And so anyway,
that's interesting. I did not know that. I knew about the girl, though. Somebody else reported on that bullet going through, and they showed a normal brain in her brain,
mm-hmm.
and how this channel is in her brain. It's sort of like as you said, like there's a straw. It happens to be filled with some sort of a fluid, but it just sort of like slid on through and out.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So if you're going to get shot in the face, that's the way to do it. You know?
I guess.
I don't recommend
getting shot at all.
I do not.
No. So, you know, we have a Grand Fondo.
Coming up in the
fall. In Ohio, September 2nd. And I want to mention it because they contacted me and they need two types of volunteers, street marshals and aid stations. So if you're in Ohio or you want to come to Ohio and you don't want to ride the Grand Fondo, although I would think maybe you might, but maybe you're going to support a rider who is doing the Grand Fondo, volunteer. It's so much fun. Volunteers actually have more fun oftentimes than riders. I can tell you that from being a ride director for many, many years. The ride starts in Groveport, Ohio, travels south into the Hocking Hills region of the state. It's very pretty down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could just go to ohiograndfondo.com, and there's a whole page about how to sign up and what you want to do. So if you're interested, I think that would be cool.
All right.
That'd be fun. All right.
Let's move along here.
We're moving along. Our next guest is in Richmond, Virginia. His name is Craig Dodson, and as I said at the beginning of the program, he is the head of a very interesting organization called the Richmond Cycling Corps, and he deals with inner city children who live in public housing, and his goal is to get them out. Let's find out how he does that. Good evening, Craig. Thanks for joining us on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Thanks for having me.
So evidently we have a mutual friend, Kimberly Coates.
Kimberly Coates, yeah. She's a become a cyber buddy. Yeah, she follows us and supports our program, and she's actually just been a great advocate of our program. She's doing some great stuff in Rwanda, and I think just has been a great supporter of what we do.
Well, let's talk about what you do. So the Richmond Cycling Corps, for which you're the director, seems to have a simple one-line motto: can't stop, won't stop. What does that mean?
That's a great question. One of my board members, who we brought on in 2010, he would, his sort of signature, when he would sign an email or write an email to me, would just say sort of can't stop, won't stop. And I would read that, and I sort of adopted it because it was just, you know, something I sort of kept as my personal motto to keep plugging away and keep working at getting this organization off the ground and getting it to where it is. And so as I sort of started to adopt it, it just kind of got passed on into the battle cry of the program at large and with the kids. And so we just sort of started branding it and branded, you know, t-shirts and our bread trucks that we use to get the equipment out to the kids. And it sort of became our purpose, you know, in terms of the launch pad with the kids. You know, it's just a can't stop, won't stop mentality. You can do this and don't give up. That's how it came to be.
So explain what the Richmond Cycling Corps is and how it did start.
Well, it started, it sort of spawned from, I put together a concept semi-pro racing team back in 2008 that was called Richmond Pro Cycling. And the concept was to have elite bike racers who were community ambassadors, but real community ambassadors, and to leverage their sort of character equity as these elite cyclists to go back into the community and help the community. And it got some okay traction. By and large, it was challenging because we had these elite athletes and we're trying to grow that aspect of the program, but then we also had this community outreach and we were trying to grow that, and they were both sort of stifling each other. And so we basically, just dropped the elite cycling portion of the program and just really hit out and develop the community outreach side of things. So that's basically where it started, and where it's gone is we work with kids in public housing and use cycling as our vehicle to change their lives. So we use the bikes as a way to connect with the kids and give them an outlet. And then once we've got them sort of really attached to the bike and riding the bike and everything that goes along with the character development that cycling tends to give you, because no one's going to get you to the top of that hill. You sort of have to do it yourself, and that takes a lot of hard work and dedication and drive and all these things that are often lacking in character development with youth in public housing. It evokes that, it gets that out of them and starts to develop it. And so that's basically what the program does. We look at it sort of a lock and key. So the youth having these sort of voids or gaps in their character development, that being the lock, and we're using cycling basically as a key to sort of get in there and unlock that. For some a lot of kids, it's very effective to what the program is.
So where do the bikes come from?
Where do they come from? Well, in the beginning, they were just really cobbled together. I put together a fleet of about 10 bikes the first year, and I spent a lot of time at bike shops going through used parts bins and putting them together. We purchased a few frames and basically just kept the fleet going. We were on those bikes for basically close to 2 years when we first got the program going, and I had all the bikes painted the same, and that seemed to work pretty well in terms of the youth. In the beginning, it was just sort of like everyone had a blue bike, and that was okay. As they got better and better, they started to figure out that weight does matter, and the lighter bikes were often the ones that they went for first. So our equipment over the years, and then we started getting more donations, so more as folks learned about our program, we got more donated bikes. And then we learned that there's a huge compatibility issue with when you're getting donated bikes to try to keep a fleet of bikes going. So
sure.
You've got seven speed versus 8 speed, 9 speed, 10 speed, you know, all these different compatibility issues with drivetrains and headsets and all this stuff. So right when we were a few months back, we were really pushing the ceiling with these issues and reaching the limits of trying to keep all these bikes together and working week in and week out. We fortunately just got a grant through the CarMax Foundation, which is going to supply 48 new bikes to
wow.
our kids.
Good
yeah.
for you.
So we're super excited about that. So we're going to have essentially a fleet of bikes for each style of riding that we're doing, which is road, mountain, city rides, BMX track. We've got a new skills park that the Richmond Moore put in, which is a pump track and all sorts of drops and logs and mountain bikes. And, you know, so we're going to have everything for the kids now.
So how many kids are there in your program at this moment? Let's just talk about, you know, summer of 2012 for right now.
Yeah, great. So we cap the roster right now to 15.
Okay.
So we don't have this. We have a come one, come all. But to build prestige, around the program, we found that we really had to cap it. And then basically we've got what we call the roster, and then we have a reserve list. And the roster is set at 15. If you and each after every session with the kids, we re-rank the youth, and that rank is based on attendance and behavior. We don't care how fast you ride, how long you ride. That doesn't matter. It's just you show up and you have a good attitude. So we're looking for those behavioral changes. It is about cycling, but again, it's using cycling to correct and develop those better behavioral patterns. So we re-rank them. And, you know, those numbers, 13, 14, 15, at the bottom of the roster, if they continue to sort of slip up and we see that, we will remove them from the roster. They will get put to the back of the reserve list, and a kid who's been waiting to get in at the front of the reserve list will then get placed onto the roster. So that's how it works, and it keeps the kids on the roster motivated to not slip up, to, you know, basically be on point and, you know, stay positive and stay in the program and you know, put in the effort and do the right things to stay in. So it incentivizes the program as a whole.
So
that's how we do it.
Are all the kids boys, or do you have boys and girls?
We have girls as well. Yeah, this year we have we currently have 5 girls out of the 15 on the roster. So a third of the roster right now is female. We're just pumped about that. It's, you know, when we first started, we had no girls. Now we're, you know, essentially 33% of the roster is female. That's huge for us.
So how long has your program been going on?
We've been going on. We started essentially where it is right now in 2010, so we are about 2.5 years old.
And so if you look back at the kids who were with you, say, in 2010, how has it changed their lives?
Yeah, so one of the first one of the members of that first crop of kids in 2010, he stayed with us. His name is Chris Mason. He's sort of become the keystone kid for the program and the beacon of success. So he started with us, and just last fall, he was Richmond's first inner-city kid to ride 100 miles in one day. And it was a 100-mile century ride with close to 13,000 feet of climbing in the western end of Philadelphia. It's a Livestrong Charity Ride.
Wow.
In really, really bad conditions. It was a downpour, lightning. I'd say less than half the riders that started that ride finished, and he was one of them. And from that point on, his entire life has really changed. There was a huge story in a Richmond magazine that was written about the program and him, where the reporter followed us for about a month and followed us on that trip up to Philadelphia. He went on to win the Metro Richmond Youth of the Year for Boys and Girls Club. He's then gone on to get now he's up to close to $20,000 of scholarship money for college, and he's going to college. And when we first found Chris, you know, that really wasn't in the cards for him. He was a 15-year-old sophomore that, you know, it was sort of on the fence of which way he was going to go in life. And he's one of eight, and he's just a month ago, he's the first one in his family to complete high school. So, you know, these are the things that we're seeing, the changes. And he, like I said, he's become that icon for the other kids, which is very important that we have a role model that's so tangible for them, someone they see every day in the neighborhood and they can relate to, that is so far they're going to make it, they're going to get out of public housing. And that's the promise that we make our kids, that if you stay with the Richmond Cycling Corps, we will get you out of public housing. And that's a bold promise. And Chris is the first one to exit the program, so far we're batting 1,000.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Craig Dodson, who is the director of Richmond Cycling Corps in Richmond, Virginia, and evidently the nation's most successful inner-city youth cycling program. And that happened in less than 2 years. How did you get that distinction, and who made that distinction for you?
Well, we kind of made it ourselves, to be honest.
Oh, good for you.
We looked around at what else was out there, and we know that that we're producing what these kids are accomplishing and what they're doing. We've dialed it in really better than anyone else has tried. And I think that's why a lot of groups have started to reach out to us, you know, from all over the country, who have either tried to do this and haven't been able to get traction, or are thinking about doing this and want to figure out how to do it. It's an interesting one to get going, because we don't use the term inner city loosely. It's not just kids within city limits. I mean, we're literally working in the worst, you know, public housing project in Richmond when you look at at-risk behavior and crime. So we're going right at it. We're knuckles down with our approach. And so when you look at what our kids are accomplishing in terms of mileage, I mean, we've got 11-year-olds riding 50 miles in one day. We've had Richmond's first inner-city female to ride 50 miles in one day. We've got, you know, 15 youth in the program who are all capable of riding at least 50, 70, if not 100 miles in one day right now. What they're accomplishing on mountain bikes, what they're accomplishing at the skills park, what they're accomplishing on the road, and then how this has just elevated their self-confidence and everything. I mean, you know, I really don't think there's a program in the nation that can really, in terms of the consistency and the output, what these kids are doing, that can really match what we're doing. And I think it just comes down to authenticity. You know, we're not interested in just putting a bunch of inner city kids on bikes and taking pictures. We're the real deal, and we're really hard on ourselves. You know, the staff and the volunteers, the people involved. I think we're kind of driven by guilt. You know, we're really hard on ourselves, and we hold ourselves very accountable. We almost have a sense of guilt if we don't feel like we are committing to these youth as well as we could be. So we're always trying to push the bar. We're never satisfied. It's never good enough for any of us in the program, not one staff member, not one volunteer. And so we're always pushing that envelope. And so we always look at RCC as an unfinished product that we're always trying to make better and evolve. I don't think we'll ever look at it as a finished product. There's always a better way to reach these kids, reach more kids, or get them to reach higher. So, I think that's how we got there, and I think we're going to continue to be there. And
So if you were to sort of wrap the the concept into something that would be saleable, and I don't mean saleable as in you're going to just wrap it up and sell it to somebody. But
sure.
if you were to say to a city like Cleveland, for example, that has several public housing areas, what do you think other cities, are you planning to do that? Are you going to put this into some sort of format that somebody like Cleveland could come along and say, hey, we want a Cleveland Cycling Corps and be able to, quote unquote, sell the concept?
Right, and that's why we went after a city on it, because we always thought about scale. So absolutely. I think it'll be a few years out. One thing that we're finding is what makes this program here in Richmond so successful is simply the people behind it. And at first you think it's, you know, maybe it's something operationally, it's the bikes, it's the way you get the bikes to the kids, it's the program itself in terms of the calendar, the events you do, this and that. As we stepped and sort of pulled back and widened the lens a little bit of how we view the program, I think by and large it's the people behind it. And they're one in a million, and sometimes I got to pinch myself because I don't know how we managed to get the people that we have such a concentrate of just a few in this program. I mean, how they ended up really finding us, or we found them, is amazing. And so, to answer your question, I think it's very scalable, but it's all about finding the right people. If you don't have the right people involved, it's not going to work. You can't reach them. And so it's hard to quantify how you find those people. I mean, how do you, you know, what are you looking for? It's so hard. If they don't connect with the kid, if there's some sort of gap in terms of relatability or authenticity, it's not going to work. I don't care how new the bikes are and, you know, how cool the cycling kits are. You're not going to reach these kids. And so scale is based on the quality of the people involved.
So let me ask you my last question, which is, why did you do this?
And I didn't do this.
Yeah.
Why did I do this?
Yeah,
why? Why not?
Well, that's a good answer, but...
Why not? It's the right thing to do. And, you know, I've never been a financially driven person since I was a kid. It was never something, you know, I never chased the dollar. You know, I just sort of hit a point with cycling. You know, I was racing, and I just sort of got, you know, I think at some point most people get over racing for various reasons, and I had various reasons. And so when I pulled out from racing, you know, and I basically stopped, I had taken so much from the sport. You know, I was a pretty narcissistic bike racer, and the sport had given me so much in terms of, it carved the path for my life. You know, my life's education, my formal education, everything was following the bike. And I hadn't really given much back. And I just thought, you know, I've got the ability to do this. The resources are there. I just have to find them. And so why not do it? And I couldn't think of a reason not to do it, I think. And then as I've gotten more plugged into doing this, and it's become really my life's work, and everything that I put all my focus and energy into, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing. So these kids have hands down become more, they've inspired me more than any racer I'd ever looked up to when I was younger, or you know, someone standing on the podium of the Tour de France. I mean, these kids inspire me more than anything right now. So, that's the best answer. I did it because it was the right thing to do, and I keep doing it because it's the right thing to do.
Well, why don't you let our listeners know how they can find out about the Richmond Cycling Corps and where your website is?
Yeah, absolutely. Find out more at richmondcyclingcorps.org, and that's CORPS on Corps. And then we also have a Facebook page, a Twitter. If you go to our Facebook page, you'll see a whole bunch of videos and photography, and I think it really goes through, and people can get a great behind-the-scenes view of what we do. So check it out.
Well, I appreciate you talking with us this evening on The Outspoken Cyclist, and good luck with your kids, and I hope you get your program growing and bigger and more success. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Diane.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Craig Dodson joined us from Richmond, Virginia.
Would you say that's passionate?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. You know, I have to give him a lot of credit. Obviously, these people just do amazing things with these kids. These are probably hardcore kids.
Cycling inspires so many people
to
do so many things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. It's a great testament to the power of the sport that we spend so much time in.
Well, I certainly wish him a lot of luck with the Richmond Cycling Corps.
Absolutely. I did, as promised,
yes, you did.
A little research while you were chatting there, and I have some
times.
Olympic television cycling schedule information for us.
I'm not sure anybody really wants to hear this. This is all Eastern time zone, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
And don't forget, that's what your DVR is for.
Oh, right. Or your TiVo or whatever
you
do.
It is, yeah.
So Wednesday, August 1st at 4 a.m. we'll be cycling. And then again at 9 a.m. And we don't know if it's a repeat of the 4 a.m. because it's like 5 hours later.
Probably it is, but anyway.
I don't know. Saturday, which would be August 4th, is 4 a.m., so it's a week from today, and 9 a.m. And then Sunday, which would be August 5th, 4 a.m. and 9 a.m. And that's pretty much all Greg could find on cycling on NBC Sports.
I found that on a site called areyouwatchingthis.com.
Well, there you have it.
So for whatever that is worth, you might check back there and see if there is any other coverage scheduled as the week goes on.
I actually got a little note from one of my friends that you will be able to get some Olympic cycling coverage if you have iCloud.
Okay.
I don't know what that means because I'm a little new to the Apple I market, but something about that there will be free Olympic coverage if you pay for iCloud space or something.
If you know of a place to pick up some Olympic cycling coverage, because it does tend to be a little bit harder to find than Tour de France coverage.
Yeah, I mean,
you
can watch the
tour.
Yeah,
that's
page.
Right. Throw a post out on the Facebook page and let the rest of us know where you're finding your Olympic cycling coverage these next couple of weeks.
Excellent.
All right. We'll be back next week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I know you've got some great guests lining up.
We have a guy named Ryan Schneider. I met him at press camp. Go figure. Mm-hmm. Another journalist. He works for Lava Magazine. We're going to learn about triathlons and why he left the gaming industry to write for the triathlon industry.
Okay.
Kind of interesting. We're going to speak with Ohio bike lawyer Steve Magus, and we'll have some other surprises.
All right, very good. We'll see you then.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.